Okay, here we are.
Blog Talk Radio.
I like that song anyway. That's a cool song.
Yeah, I liked it.
But yeah, we're here because...
Well, here we are.
Yeah. We have with us tonight is Carl Kafer.
Greetings, salutations,
and
everyone.
And Joey Vento.
Hi, everybody. Happy holidays.
Absolutely.
And for those of us who knew Independent Record Store, especially for Carl and Joey, who really knew God. Well, we had a tragic death in Those Who Love Vinyl. And I'm going to let Joey try this because he basically said he lived there during the weekend.
Yeah.
So take it away, Joey.
That was that. Let me tell you that, and Carl knows, because anybody that spent time hanging out in the village will always remember the great shops that used to be there, like Bleecker Bob's and Jerry O'Linger's, which was right next door. On West 4th Street, I believe. So it was just the amount of places you can go on a Saturday night to buy anything, vinyl, and Tower Records, and even before Tower Records, there were such great places. But Bleecker Bob's was like the place to go to get stuff that nobody else had.
No, and that's very true. That's very true.
Yeah.
Finish up, Joey. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say it was an experience going in there because he had everything that you'd want. If you were looking for something in particular, the guy knew his stuff. It used to be. It was a former its previous use in the 60s, it was a lounge. It was a place where bands like Sir Douglas Quintet and Love and Spoonful actually played.
Nice.
So it has a long, rich history of having something to do with the classics. So yeah, go ahead, Carl.
Well, I was in New York from 81 to 87, and I was basically on the East Village, not the West Village.
Right.
So my two places I went to were of course, Tower Records, which was up by that time, and
mm-hmm.
Sounds, which was the East Village version of Bleecker Bob's. But when I got over to the West Village, which was maybe not real often, I would get to Bleecker Bob's, and the one thing I do remember was I had heard this song on LIR, and I loved it, and I didn't know who the band was. And so I was there, so I said, there's this song. Pulled it out right away. They were really cool, and I went there when I couldn't find anything else. When I was looking for something that I couldn't find anything else, someone who had it or someone had to order it or whatever the case. And that album was XTC. It was the Big Express. And so all I could tell you in terms of, maybe in general terms, Bleeker Bob's, these stores that we're talking about were independents. And what does that mean? Okay, really. An independent store is going to reflect the philosophy of the owner and the likes and dislikes of the owner, but it's also going to be something where you don't find the cookie cutter things that everyone expects.
Right.
So each store of the three stores I've mentioned, each had a strong point for me. So if I was looking for soundtracks, I'd go to Sounds. If I was looking for normal, everyday rock and roll at that time, which was a lot of new wave and punk, Tower was really good. But if I wanted imports, if I wanted stuff outside the norm, it would be Bleeker Bob's.
Right.
And it's an important thing that we're losing, you know, retail and independent stores in New York. I mean, Joey, you're there. I'm here in New Jersey. I don't get to the city that often. But the difference between the 70s and 80s and now is just like, it's mind-boggling, because what has happened is that it's all corporate stuff now. I mean, I was reading an article now that Dunkin' Donuts has opened up a storefront once a week in New York City for the last year and a half. Seriously.
Yeah.
You know, and so the dreaded G word that Stephen talks about, which is gentrification, has truly taken over New York City. It's unfortunate.
It is. And it has.
I like to say that Joey and Carl was alive at the most interesting time, because the independent record stores used to be the norm. Tower Records was the first national chain music store.
Record store.
Record store. Was the first. And after that, you see like small stores pop up, like Coconuts, FYE, Tape World.
Sam Goody's.
Sam Goody's.
Yeah.
No, but notice that they didn't survive either, a lot of those places. And what has happened, of course, is the advent of the Amazon type of delivery system. And now people, you know, are on their computers, oh, I can get this, I can get that. They don't even go to brick and mortars. Now,
a lot of times, like that.
But my oh, hello.
Yeah?
You got attacked again, Stephen?
No. I'm here.
Oh, okay. Okay, so one of the things is that I owned my own music store for a while. I've been in retail for many, many, many years. I also worked for a company called Music and Arts, which wanted to be the Walmart of music stores. So I was working for the quote enemy for a long time. But the one thing about it is that even with this corporate takeover and the delivery system, these stores are very vital, because they're different than they're different because the people behind them care. And they look out for their customers, and they find things, and they do the work. You know, that's something that is really important. and it's called customer service and knowing your customers. And right. I'd rather go to a small store than a big chain in a heartbeat anytime.
Yeah. I agree. Some of my most memorable music moments, a lot of music that I discovered was playing over, you know, in a shop, in a small shop, and I discovered so many different local bands and stuff like that in these little shops, and then, you know, the proprietor would know who they were, and you know, they would have a CD or something, or old bands on vinyl that and you had a connection. You always had a connection. Like in Bleecker Bob's, you ran into people that when you were flipping through the albums, you might be making friends with someone right next to you that was also into the same music that you were or knew of it, you know. So it's an experience. It was a good experience to go to places like that, and they're all gone. There's a resurgence now with vinyl, and I haven't been to the Village in many, many years, but I don't know if it's the same. Someone that's maybe gone there recently, maybe.
I was there about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
And there was one place. That was it.
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah. Village.
Yeah, I know.
Do you guys remember when, once a year, all the magazines put out the top 10 places for single people to meet?
Oh, yeah.
And you would always see Record Store in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's and it's interesting what Carl said about the places that aren't around anymore, like Tower Records, which when Tower Records was at its height, it was almost like you never thought they'd go out of business. They went out of business so fast that many people didn't realize they were gone. There were a couple of chains up here, up in Paramus. There was a big one, and they just completely, you know. And the digital stuff worries me. It really worries me because even DVDs are starting to go because of this live streaming that people seem to enjoy. Music, the CDs are also. You know, nobody has a CD anymore. No, they don't even have CD players in the cars anymore. And no. I happen to like CDs. You know, I've got a big collection, and it's I would hate to think that that'll all go out one day like cassettes did. But
they come back.
There's someone that just
is producing a new type of cassette tape and player. I just read that not too long ago. But the one thing about the delivery system always changes, but it's the collectors that keep these things going. I could tell you right now that vinyl was at its best peak in 20-some years, okay? But it was the collectors that kept it going to get there.
Yeah.
Carl.
You know, and that's another thing, too. I have to give a shout-out to a store. I was in Fresno for quite a while, and Vicky's out there and would go visit her and stay for quite a while. And there's a store called Tower District Records. Now, it's not Tower Records. There's a little area in Fresno called the Tower District. And so I was not in the best of financial shape, and I'd go and I have a really good collection and I'd sell a couple, and they were fair to me. They were incredibly fair. We'd talk and I got to really like the guys. Now, I had the same situation out here in Jersey, And these people were cutthroat. You know, it wasn't the same thing. You know, it's about caring about your customer and what position they're in. This is why an independent is so important. Okay, I'll shut up.
No, I was going to ask you, Carl, was it a month ago or a little bit sooner when the whole iTunes mess happened?
I'm not that familiar with that, so why don't you tell us?
Well, what happened was that iTunes lost the rights to about 1,500 to 2,000 movies. So what happened was they not only removed it from their servers, if you had bought a copy from them, they removed that from their hard drive, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. That was about 3 months ago. I was like, that was like August or so, September, I think.
But how scary is like this from us? You own it. No, you don't.
Yeah, it is. That's the scary thing about all that. And how it's so different. It's like night and day, like we were saying, with small, independent little stores that you can go in. Some of them were really great. There was some that I don't even remember their names in the West Village, East Village, that you would walk into. Some of them you walk down into the street. You walk down into a cellar, and the store was underneath the
sounds.
Street.
That was Sounds, I can guarantee you.
Yeah, Sounds. I do remember Sounds. I do remember Revolver Records, which you walked up to.
Yeah, I do remember Revolver.
But there are a lot of little ones that, and I have a lot of 45s, with picture sleeve 45s that were very rare. They were hanging up on the walls. That was like you'd be like a kid in a candy store when you'd come in and you'd see 45s like lining the walls, old Beatle 45s, British bands like the Small Faces, stuff like that, all up on the shelves, and different prices. I mean, some of them were expensive. Now, we wouldn't look at it as that way now, but some of them were pretty pricey, and they're all gone. Those are, in some cases, the buildings are gone, because NYU took up most of the real estate in the village.
Yeah.
So a lot of those little shops are all gone. I mean, I have such great memories about walking into places like that and discovering new ones. Each time we'd go down, my wife and I, we'd discover something new. We said, we didn't see this before. It was great. There was even a record store called, do you remember the record store in the subway?
Yes, absolutely I do.
Yeah, you'd get off. I forgot what stop it was, whether it was, I'm not sure whether it was 14th Street or near 42nd Street, but there was a record store.
It was 14.
Yeah, inside the subway. I mean, you could see the train going by. And it opened up into a shop. And you'd go in there, and they had stuff in there from the 50s. They had old stock because it had been open since the 40s, most likely.
I love that place. I picked up some good stuff there.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember that place. There was another place, too. And I'm going to piss off Stephen here for a while. So I was in the East Village, and I tried my darndest to get into the transgression no budget thing, and that includes like Lydia Lunch and Beth B and all those people. Okay, so there was a record store on Avenue B. Now at that point in the 80s, that Alphabet City was basically like post-war War II France, and I'm not joking.
You're not joking. I know you're not.
I'm not joking. Bombed out buildings, crack houses, that sort of thing. But that was the one place if you wanted any Lydia Lunch music or any of the no budget, that was the only place in the city where you could get it.
Yeah.
And so you know, I try hanging out there and catching up with people that were in it to try to get into this thing, and it never worked. I did run into the John Doe there once, though, when we had a nice conversation. But yeah, I mean, the thing about it, too, and I have to give a little info on me. We have a music store, but I'm a record collector and have been since I've been like 14, 15 years old.
Yeah.
Okay? My folks got a 78 player with about 400 records. And I just looked and I'm like, that's mine. And I got hooked. So at my height, I had over 20,000 records.
Wow.
And this, we had a quote store above our store, which was my store. I called it Vinyl Valhalla, but what it was basically is, since I was so connected with the dealers, it was sort of like a wholesale place as opposed to the general public. If the general public wanted to come in, fine, but mostly it was dealers. And you know, and I've dealt with dealers all my life. And you know, if they're fair with me, I'm fair with them. And that's the whole thing. It's all about, the independent is all about the relationship with the customer.
That's right.
You know, and the customer means something. You're not just a number. You're not just a credit card number for Amazon or that sort of thing. You mean something because you come in, we have a personal relationship. I look for things for you, so on and so forth. I give you a call, hey, I found this, I found that, are you interested? That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what we're missing.
Like this local store that was in my local town, Campbell County, this guy was great. It was like I bought Natural Born Killers, the soundtrack. And I was like, I love this guy. He's like, which guy? And I was like, the guy who did the first and last songs in the movie. He's like, oh, okay. And then I went back there a week later. He's like, try this. I'm like, what is this? You know that guy you like? Yeah, here's the album those songs were off of, The Future. Oh, cool. And then another week, you know, about a week later, I went back in there. He's like, hey, try this. What is it? You know that guy? Yeah, it's his first greatest hits album. Boom, I was hooked.
That's well, you know what? They were drug dealers. Going.
Yeah, they were like,
now these guys
were like drug dealers. They go in, they know what you like, and they're like, yeah, here, try this, man.
They do.
Just it's your beat.
So I have a story, and 14 years old, we moved to Bradford, Pennsylvania. My father has bought a music store. And, of course, in a German household, I have to work there. Trust me. But four doors down from us was a little head shop / record store. And the guy's name was Jerry O'Wallaby. To this day, no one has had such an influence on my musical taste than Jerry. Nobody.
Wow.
Because it was there. Well, let's see. What were the first at that store? Let's see. My first joint, of course. Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
The Kinks. Like two of my favorite bands of all time. You know, Shel Silverstein, and who was the other one? Pink Floyd I knew, but he introduced me to the mid Pink Floyd, which was Uma Goma, and that sort of thing. Yeah, all head music, of course. You know, but you know, it's important to connect. And this is what Bleeker Bob did. You know, how long was he there? 40 some years, something like that.
Yeah, he was there about 40 something years. And you know, he managed to change with the times musically, you know, and he had a very, very old stock there. It was always the same, you know, he reused everything. It was always the same jackets and album liners and all that stuff. But, you know, he just couldn't, the rents went so sky high in the 80s. He was having a lot of trouble at that time. And then he got sick. And the very same thing happened to Jerry Olinger, who was the movie guy who owned for years Jerry Olinger's movie material store on West 4th Street.
Yeah.
And this very same thing happened, really. And he just passed away, too. But he, again, the rent hikes, this flushing out of small businesses that, you know, that people loved. People went to these things for years. And, you know, Carl was talking about, you know, firsts, different first things that you ever did. And many of us, you know, we heard our first, you know, music that would change our lives, or we looked at our first movie stills, or we, you know, it was just a nice thing. And they're, unfortunately, no one has taken the place of, not there at least anyway. There are some local record stores now that are popping up. Some are around here too, but it's not the same. It's the repackaged vinyl, reissues and stuff. There's nothing truly old that you can find. You could go to old shows. I mean, there are record conventions. Stuff like that. I think there's a record convention that happens on West 57th Street each year that you can go to in a hotel. But but a lot has to be said for, you know, for the first time we experience things in these places.
Well, you know, nowadays with the repackaging, what they're finding is that these little stores that are coming up there are basically the reissues. Just new,
yeah.
They're not surviving either, and the ones that do survive, they find is a combination of both new and used, and vintage, and there's a couple things. I read an article, and I actually was talking to Stephen about this over the phone. So, but there are a couple reasons. And one of them, of course, you mentioned with rent, you know, brick and mortar these days, particularly in New York City, is insane because of the rents. But you would expect that there's a lot of change in the retail, and there's a lot of empty storefronts, and there are. But it's not as bad as you think it is, because the question is this: what if I give you a percentage number, and the percentage is about 64% nationwide, of all of the storefronts out there, what do you think comprises that percentage, the biggest percentage of storefronts?
Nowadays, about 20%.
Yeah, I would think so.
No, what? What type of business?
Oh, what type of...
What type of business?
Restaurants.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Well, of course, we talked about it. Restaurants.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And even they're having trouble because nowadays with Uber,
right?
You know, you can get this from that place, that from that place, and people are so picky that no one's coming into a restaurant. They're having a difficult time too. And it's all about delivery system. It's all about this change. And
that's right.
The only ones that are going to survive are the ones that adapt to it. Maybe not completely change, but know that can be part of their business too. It's going to be tough. It's going to be really tough. And we're going to lose a lot of independents. It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But brace yourself. It's happening.
Well, that's, I mean, we can, you know, these restaurants, the small cafes that we remember, again, where there was a multitude of them, the same way there was a multitude of little record shops, and there was little film stores. There was, you know, the big Kim's Music, Kim's Video, Kim's, that had everything under the sun, but restaurants too. I mean, Diana and I can tell you the smallest little cafes that we would go into in the village that are, they, I mean, the storefronts are taken over today by, I mean, whether it's another restaurant or it's a, you know, a bank or, you know, they just wipe it away. The Fillmore East, which is in the village, was in the village, got wiped away and got turned into a few other things before they totally changed, you know, tore down the marquee and turned it into a bank. Now it's a bank. It's been that way for a while. But, you know, and the little restaurants that were around it, you know, little cafes, you can just walk in. But you're right, they're having a lot of trouble too, because they come in, especially around here, they'll come in and you'll see a new restaurant and, oh, let's try that. And months later, they're just gone because it's just not, it's not easy. It's not easy.
No, it's not. And you know, I mean, I go back.
Did the Deli close this year, Carl, or was that last year?
That was last year. That was last year. But I was just going to say that for those that are listening that don't understand something about New York, if you've never been there, you know, Joey was a West Village person. I was an East Village person. Now, you would think, oh, well, they're both a village and that. But there's really a demarcation there.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, we were talking about restaurants. I cried the day that Leshko's went under. I literally cried my eyes out. A friend of mine called me up and said Leshko's is gone. Seriously. I spent so much time. You could go to these little places in the East Village. Now, this is 80s money. Okay, so you have to keep that in mind. $5-6 get a full meal.
Yeah, sure.
Trust me, when you're making $250 a week, you know, that's beautiful. Trust me. You know,
you remember one of his last years before he retired, the mad William Gaines did something called The Future of New York, and basically it was a giant sign outside New York City said New York City Land.
Yeah.
And it was about how New York has turned into this giant playground and amusement park for people who don't live there.
That's right.
And that's exactly.
That's
right. Absolutely. You know, I mean,
Nashville done that way. When I went there in about 92, it was still Nashville, you know.
Wow.
Then I went there about 2001, 2002. It was Nashville Land.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I don't know if Joey knows the story, but those who have listened to the two of us on CastEAD have probably heard this or actually experienced it. I was in New York City for the first time in years. This was 2005, 2006, something like that. And I visited a friend of mine, and I went to Times Square. I went to 42nd Street and 8th Avenue. Now, back in the day, when my parents came or anyone came to visit me, I made sure we went down the gauntlet so they understood how scary New York could be. I made a point of that. So on the corner of 42nd and 8th, there used to be a porno shop. The name escapes me right now. And I was at the corner and I looked where this used to be, and there was a Toys R Us gymnasium. Now, you know, karma's a bitch now with Toys R Us. But why don't you go from there, Stephen, and tell the story?
Well, it was Showland, and
Showland, that's it.
Yeah. Well, this is a PG-13 show, Carl, so we'll skip the rest of that story.
Skip the one word.
Showland.
Okay, you're breaking up, Stephen. I'll take it from here and skip the word. But we had Jeannie Silver on the show, and I was telling this story because we were both commiserating how New York had changed. And I told her this whole story. And she says, "Oh my God, there must be a river of blank under that building." And our producer at the time, Keith Hayes, absolutely lost it.
Yeah.
He lost it. No, things have changed so much in the city. And the thing is, to me, you know, I've been in retail almost all my life, and I appreciate my customers, because without my customers, you know, I wouldn't have a store.
Right.
You know, and there's this communal sense when a store is like that. When we had our music store, you know, we had all these guitars and that, and all these kids would come in, right? And my father, you know, wouldn't let them touch the guitars, and I would, okay. And so in many ways, it was the place for these kids to be, you know, sort of a safe place. And I'm very proud. One of the kids that came in, I sold his first guitar to. His name is Jeff Fetterman, and you may not know the name, but he has made quite a name for himself on the blues circuit. He's played with Johnny Lang. He's played with Anna Popovich. He's played with Joey Bazzamazzo. You know, just great guy. And we keep in touch. And he's thanked me for really letting him find his passion. And this is what any good independent is going to do.
Yeah.
They're going to let the customer find their own way, lead them along, give them ideas, and that customer is going to come back and back and back. And it's, you know, we really are mourning the loss of Bleecker Bob, because he's of the old school, as am I. We're not going to be here that long. And hopefully, through the love that we showed our customers and our craft, you know, that will be passed on to somebody who then cares and can pass it on to another generation. That's the real dream of someone like Bleecker Bob. I can guarantee you.
That's
that.
What most fans, music and movies, forget. Our job is, one, to love the movies, yes, of course. But the second and really more important job is to pass on that love to a younger generation and teach them that
that's
they're supposed to pass on that love.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely. That's the whole reason. You know, that's the whole reason for it, is to, you know, pass it on, make sure that, you know, young kids too get to experience it. They might not experience it in the same way, because everybody's entitled to, you know, something that they like from their own generation and this and that, but as long as they appreciate it. And I've said this many, many times on the show and to you guys, and when you've seen me in person, that's why we do what we do. It's to inspire them to look a little closer into these films or a particular soundtrack or piece of music. But that's the whole point. The whole point is to make sure that it doesn't, you know, these stories go on. And that's what Bleecker Bob, because he would tell a lot of stories. He was very, very sarcastic. I don't know if you know that. Once you got past that kind of thing, then he would kind of tell you the stories about different people that had walked in there. And so many people had walked in there. So many of the people that we idolize have walked in there.
Bowie?
Yeah.
So many. Bowie came to mind because I heard her story about Bowie from Bleecker Bob.
Oh, yeah. yeah.
Me and Carl are friends from Steve at Monster Bash. We know about New York sarcastic dealers, don't we, Carl?
Yes.
I'll tell you a quick story about Steve from Monster Bash. We were talking, you know, we're one of the few people that smoke. So we're smoking outside, and he comes over to me, and we started talking. Oh, I'm from New York. Oh, so was I. You know, and it was like, oh, you were there? Oh, my God, CBGB's? The Mud Club? You know, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's this connection.
One thing I want
to go back to a little bit, okay? So I had my own music store, and this I come back from New York in 87. So I took over the store. Of course, that means that I took over what music was playing, all that sort of thing. I had a nice boom box. And so there's lots of XTC, there's lots of stuff going on. And then, of course, I was collecting the records, too. So I had a turntable down there. But the kids that came in, and they were all basically teenage boys, they said, well, what is this? What is that? And so one of the things I always said to them, oh, I like this. Why? Why do you like it? Why? Well, I don't know. I just like it. Not good enough. Why? Always I tried to make them, you know, look at it in a critical sense. Not in an objective sense, but just so they knew why they liked something.
Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't just go with music. I suggest books. I do all of that. So I was sort of this mentor, Sherpa, to a bunch of kids, including my ex-fiancé's two kids. John, the older one, had two friends of his, and I hired them to alphabetize the vinyl stock upstairs, of course. Did they do any work? No. But that's not why I hired them. That wasn't the reason. And you know, it meant a lot to see these kids grow to me. And to know that I had some sort of influence. The funny thing is I get these emails from kids in Bradford, or I get a PM, you know, thanking me, you know. And what did I do? I just opened up a store and talked to them. That's all I did. That's what you're supposed to do if you're an independent. You're not under any constraints to sell a certain amount of stuff or that sort of thing. You do what you can, and you engage with your customers, and that's important. And that's what we'll lose.
It is, and that's right, exactly. That's what we're losing, and little by little, so. You know,
it's unfortunate, but you know what? I do believe that there is a silver lining because I see a lot of difficulties happening with these big Walmarts too and everything, And there is a restructuring of the web in terms of a lot of these small niche publishers, small niche stores and record labels and that. And I see a lot of that happening. So I still see that they're going to find a place. It may be a little difficult for a while, but I think that you're gonna see that. I really hope so, at least.
Yeah.
I hope so. Find a way to survive, but the problem is nowadays, and this goes with the biggest problem I have with ISS. Someone brings up a movie and says, "This is the weirdest thing I ever got," and then there's like 9 times out of 10, one person will go and say, "You call that weird? That's not weird."
Yeah, and then they go and say, "Well, look at this." Okay, that's the disconnect.
Things like weird, scary, what music you like and touch personally, that's such a liquid concept that there's no way that you're ever going to put it into a solid written on its own list.
You're not going to quantify those words. You're not going to quantify it. There's no way of quantifying strange or unusual or personal taste. There's no way to quantify that. And so each individual is different. And if you have a store, you have to realize that and be sort of this purveyor of all knowledge.
Yeah.
And so you have to be this Renaissance man. And that's the beauty of a independent store. Somebody really does it right. They become this Renaissance man who knows everything in their store, all the different styles and how they're connected. And if a person likes A band, then, they should listen to B, C, and D. They may not like them as much, or maybe they'll like one more, but they're all connected. See, that's what you're supposed to do.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, guys like Bleaker Bob and the guy from my little record store. Oh, and I didn't tell the story. This one place I used to drag my cousin Anson to on Bargetown. I fell in love with it as soon as I walked into the place, because I walked in and it was this giant record shop, Carl. And on one wall, it was covered with a mural of Frank Zappa's 200 Motel covers.
Nice.
And on the other wall was a mural of the cover from Bob Marley's Uprising.
Nice.
It was I was like, I'm in love with this place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, I should say this very briefly. Yesterday was December 4th, and that was the 25th anniversary of Frank Zappa's death. So it was a tough night for me last night. I tell you, when that happened 25 years ago, I was in my store. I had so many customers and so many friends call me. Like, "Are you all right? Are you okay?" Seriously. Frank, wherever you are, we remember, my friend. Okay, that's enough of that. We'll move on.
But yeah, I mean, to really sum up how quick it changed, you guys remember the movie Shakedown, don't you, from the late 90s, early 90s with Sam Elliott?
Sort of,
I've heard of it.
Well, it was the last movie ever filmed on 42nd Street. And James Quick announced their 10 stories that while were filming about 10 feet behind them. As soon as they filmed one building, the crew moved in and tear it down. Basically, they were trying to get the movie done while I was trying to stay ahead of the crew that was tearing down every one of the old movie theater fronts.
Yeah. That's such a... you go down Times Square now, and there are no vestiges or hardly any of what it used to be. Architecture, everything is gone. You know, you lose character.
And yeah, you do. Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing about independence. They have character. In fact, characters generally inhabit them, both the owner and the customers. But they have character. And each independent store is not like the other.
No.
They're not the same. They never are.
No.
I mean, there were two other stores in Fresno, and I mentioned Tower District Records. I never went to those places. I was there once, you know, checking it all out the first time I was there. And I liked Tower District. It was my kind of place. So that's where I went, you know.
Huh.
And we all make those choices.
You said you had something to do. You could only do like half of this show, Joey?
Yeah, I have to go, but I just wanted to make sure I, you know, got in my, my, you know, condolences for Bleecker Bob Plotkin, and you know, our condolences for the village that Carl and I remember and many people remember. You know, hopefully we'll get a chance to go down there again, and I want to take my daughter down there. But, you know, the city is constantly changing, and, you know, it's important to keep the memories alive, change with it. You know, it's not a, it could be a blessing and a curse, but, you know, inevitably we have to change with it. And, we keep forging ahead, you know, Carl, myself, you, Steve, and all those that keep stuff like this going. So it's a good thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, guys, thank you. And, you know, we'll talk soon. And, you know, happy holidays to you all. And I'll see you online. Carl, take care, buddy.
Listen, it's always a pleasure to have you on, Joey. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Carl.
My friend.
It's an honor to be talking with you guys.
Bullshit. You made me laugh.
Okay. Yeah.
And Steve, I hope
you
know that
I always talk about. What? Oh, sorry.
All right, John. Take care.
Okay, buddy. Thank you. Take care, guys. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, Carl, you know I'm always talking to you about movies as historical documents.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We've talked about that many times.
Let's try to put down right now what are the best movies to watch if you want to see what old New York was like.
Well, one of the earliest ones I would mention is West Side Story. West Side Story was filmed in a neighborhood that is long gone. They tore it down like a year after the film premiered, and that was the area basically behind Lincoln Center. And so all those tenements you see are real tenements. That's one of the earliest. Now, you can go back to like Boys Town and a number of things in the 30s. But talking about the modern era, that's probably the first one I would mention.
And don't forget Alphabet City.
Well, as I said, Alphabet City is much, much later. Now we're going to get into an R rating, folks. Just going to let you know, because if you're going to mention Alphabet City, I'm going to do the best joke from it. Okay, this is one of Paul Morrissey's films. Paul Morrissey was connected to Andy Warhol. And I'm sure he curses that these days. But so Alphabet City is in Brooklyn. okay, part of it, and then, of course, off of that city. And so one of the guys in Brooklyn, this is Bensonhurst, says, you know what the Brooklyn alphabet is? No, what is it? Fucking A, fucking B, fucking C,
yeah.
Fucking D.
But, yeah, that movie was filmed pretty close to when they gentrified Alphabet City. So you will see the bombed-out buildings and things like that.
Well, no. Actually, to be honest, that was filmed in 84. I was in New York at the time. I saw that at King's Crossing. The real work on that happened after I left. About 88, 89, they started really working on Alphabet City. And they took it from the River Inn. So they started working on Avenue D and then moved to Avenue C, B. By mid-90s, like 95, 96, that area had all changed.
Yeah, but that's really one of the plots. Hell, the whole movie plot is about gentrification.
Well, yeah, it's about rent control. It's about, you know, they want to get the better people in and so on and so forth. Absolutely. You know, but that's a little different than raising the whole area and then rebuilding, which is what I'm talking about. Because they basically raised the whole area.
That's one of the – well, there was a couple of movies. I think Tenement was shot. The outside views were shot down in Alphabet City.
Yeah. That's Avenue B, Avenue C. Maybe even Avenue D, but that's definitely B and East. No question. That's Tenement.
Yeah. And, of course, we can't
another
forget
area
you got to
talk about – another area you've got to talk about is the South Bronx. And the best testament to what the South Bronx used to be, and if I call Alphabet City post-World War II France, the South Bronx was post-World War II France after a nuclear bomb hit it. Because it was all rubble.
Yeah.
And the movie that really shows that is Wolfen. Those are actual shots of the South Bronx. That's not a set. And that's actually what it was. They found that church. They found all that rubble. That was not the production design. Trust me on that.
No. And also Fort Apache, the Bronx.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And we can't forget Basket Case because Frank Henlotter filmed it in 42nd Street because he knew that it was going to be gone soon.
Yeah.
So he wanted to capture as much footage as he could on it.
Don't forget the wonderful Hellfire Club.
That was created, that's going back to cruising.
Yeah, but I'm talking about he actually shot I don't know how to shot in the Hellfire Club.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how Freakin' got to shoot in the cruising. He built that club for him.
Yeah. Yeah, cruising is a good one.
Abel Ferrara's Driller Killer. Well, any
Abel Ferrara
and
anything he did back in the 80s, in the late 70s. Abel Ferrara was a New Yorker man. And I'll tell you who else was great. Watch any Larry Cohen film from the 80s and 70s. Seriously. Just fantastic location work.
And he was the only one to ever shoot up that high in the Chrysler Tower because He didn't tell him.
yeah, that there's a story. So they do this shoot at the Chrysler Building, and so there are all these blanks being shot, and they're dropping to the ground many floors below, and people thought that there was a someone was terrorists were taking over the building. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I wish they would have filmed them getting into the building, them hiding all the camera equipment and everything under their coats, and then just smuggling everybody in. Just, here, hurry, get up there. No one's watching.
God, I love Larry Cohen. You know another movie we should talk about? We're talking about capturing a time in New York City. Godspell. Seriously, I was the first
yeah.
film ever to film at the Twin Towers, and they have that dance on the top of the Twin Towers. The billboard thing that they do—it's just amazing. The shots of that film is so well directed. It's such a love letter to New York City. That's a film I would recommend.
Yeah, I mean, and just that whole thing, the Brooklyn Bridge, the park, just beautiful.
Now, you know, I read something, and I can't remember the movie or the TV show. It was a TV show. But on Staten Island, there was, actually not on Staten Island, it was on this special island. I forget the name of it, but there was a mental hospital, and that mental hospital has been used a lot, just like Alcatraz has been, or the Tombs, since it's been closed down. But there's that. I for the life of me, I can't remember the name of the movie or TV show, but I know that's been used as a location. You know, along with, of course, all the iconic buildings, you know, the Statue of Liberty, so on and so forth, but we're talking more about you know, capturing neighborhoods.
And don't forget Night of the Juggler with James Brolin. There's not a single interior shot in that movie. It's filmed all on the streets of New York.
Yep. And God bless Taylor Negron. Okay, if you don't understand what I'm saying, fuck it. I don't care. You played the
Night of the Juggler is on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, watch it.
Yeah, I agree. I finally caught that about
and
a year
course,
ago.
And of course, it's coming out next year on Blu-ray, but Andy Milligan's Flesh Pot on 42nd Street.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the low-budget people in the 70s and up until the 90s, like Lincoln House, that whole area of 42nd Street has been used so much. Now, I tell you somewhere else you need to go to. I was a big fan of this TV show, and I was in New York while it was being produced, and it used locations in New York that the New York Board of Tourism were really pissed at this program because it was not showing the nice side of New York. And if you want to see real New York neighborhoods and real places, watch The Equalizer. Seriously.
Yeah.
That was all shot in New York. If there were any interiors, that was shot in New York too. There were no, they would use the studio in Astoria if they needed studio. But most of it was on location.
And no joke, Equalizer killed the New York Film Banking Commission.
Yeah, they pissed them off.
They really
pissed them off.
Yeah. They pissed off the filmmakers so much, no one filmed in New York anymore.
Yeah. Or if they did, they had to get cleared by the film commission. They could only film where the film commission told them to. That's what happened.
And that's really the reason why Friday the 13th Part 8 only has 30 seconds in New York. That's all they could get cleared.
Yeah. Because they didn't want, a negative image of New York being shown. I hate to tell you this,
yeah.
It was the 70s and 80s. I lived there, okay? Fuck it. That's what it was. We wore like a badge on our shirt that we were New Yorkers back then. Oh, you were wore in Iraq? Fuck you, I live in New York. Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, just look at the difference between early 80s action films, about 80 to 86, and then from 86 on. You'll see completely different kinds of movies.
Yeah. Going back to The Equalizer, there were so many scenes in, like, strip bars and show world. They shot in show world. Just unbelievable. The grime and dirt you would see in that show. And as dirty as New York was, I never felt that it was that dangerous. If you kept your wits about you and you didn't bother people, you generally didn't have a problem. Now, I'm not saying there wasn't violence and there wasn't shit that happened. But There's what? 12 million people in that place.
Plus, they would always look for the easiest hits.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. When I moved to New York, I had a couple friends of mine that lived in Bradford, like, take me aside. You don't do this. You do this. Don't do that. Come out with me a couple times so you get the lay of the land. I'll show you how to act. Don't look up at buildings. They'll know you're a fucking tourist. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And if you looked at them like you was going to rob them, they wouldn't fuck with you.
Well, once I got there in January of 81. By March, what my theme song was?
What?
Look Sharp by Joe Jackson.
Yeah.
If you think you're going to fuck with me, look sharp. I'm fucking with you. Yeah.
Was it you or Pete who told the story where they got mugged by this guy and the guy? No, it was Pete who said he got mugged by this guy and he was so goddamn broke the mugger ended up giving him $5.
Okay, so we both have stories that are similar. Now,
it was you then.
Basically, the story was, guy came at me with a knife. I look at him like, you're welcome to take what I got. I got a Subway token and 75 cents. That's what I got. Here, look at my wallet. Nothing. I get paid in 2 days. Look at me like, fuck it, just move on. Go ahead. But I have a couple stories like that. We had, this was in the 70s, and I was in college, and we would always go to New York City to visit. And this was on one of the visits. We were at a cheap hotel, not a bad hotel, but a cheap hotel in the 42nd. And it was like 1 o'clock at night, and I'd run out of cigarettes. So I went there, and one guy, a couple guys followed me and sort of like, asking for cigarettes, and they want money. And I know this. I'm not stupid. So I said, listen, I'm just with a bunch of people. We're just visiting. I tell you what, I don't have much, but I'll buy you guys a drink. All right? And luckily, I'm like, okay. So we went into a strip bar, bought him a drink. Said, hey, guys, I'll see you later. And I left.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I understood it. We're forgetting.
What?
Super Flying Shaft.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Absolutely.
Oh, and Sweet Sweetback.
Well, no, that was New York. That was L.A. Sweetback's L.A., isn't it? That's not New York.
No. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, then just Shaft and Superfly.
You know, you know, there are other cities. And you know, I mean, if you're talking Sweet Sweetback, that's L.A. I think one of the best ones for L.A. is to live and die in L.A. That's a great, great testament to the seedier side of L.A. during that time in the 80s.
No. No.
No?
The first
okay,
5 minutes of Vice Squad during... The first 5 minutes of Vice Squad during the credits, where the director almost got shot by people who thought that he was filming them for the cops.
Okay. Jerry Sherman.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I could see that. I would agree with you on that.
That was an actor. He just opened the window to his car and stuck out a movie camera and filmed it. There's like two or three bits where he's seated in as actors who played the cops.
Right.
But besides that, that was just people on the L.A. Strip.
Right. And I'll tell you another good one for L.A., and we would forget about it, but I love the movie. And that's Night of the Comet. Night of the Comet is great
yeah.
for L.A. So is Omega Man, too.
Yeah. But like I said, those movies, if you're really curious on how it really looked back then, go watch the movies that we sent. Not for the acting or anything, just because they filmed it there, and you'll get to see those places documented.
You know, and that's true of any film. I mean... You know, there's a lot of studio stuff in the 30s, 40s, 50s, but there was a lot of stuff that wasn't studio. Night of the Hunter is amazing for the places in that was filmed. There's so much out there that are testaments to you know, neighborhoods that no longer exist all across the country. So, you know, that's something very special that I think people miss when they look at film.
Okay, well, RPG to that store and that guy. And I miss personal music stores like that. But since we got Carl.
Okay, you're breaking up, Stephen.
Just here, and just tell your
yeah. You're breaking up completely.
Call back in.
Call back in. So, you know, to finish up, you know, we were talking about places and that, but this is all about memories too. I mean, these stores that we're talking about with Bleecker Bob, you know, he was such a character, and that store was such a part of that neighborhood that going on, people are going to forget that. And people are going to miss and reminisce. And this is what a good independent store does. You know, and then we talk about places. You know, certain neighborhoods, certain places back when. Of course, you know, we all, anyone who was in New York at the time in the 80s, 70s, 80s, will miss 42nd Street. You know, and of course, let's not forget the Deuce and our friends at the Rialto Report who do all the research for them They've recreated that look extremely well. And that's a good, even though that's done digitally, that's a really good representation of what the Deuce was like. Okay, you're back. I was just mentioning the Deuce, too. Even though it's done digitally, they've done a really good job at recreating what the Deuce was during those times.
Okay. Ever since this Thanksgiving, the dumbass come in stunningly Godzilla-sized turd fashion. Thanksgiving. One, you're a racist if you watch it. Y'all ever come Thanksgiving and like it. Two, you're a bad person. It's like a Christmas story. And what was the third one that comes back at?
Oh, it was the song. Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you like me, it's cold outside, you encourage date rape.
Yeah.
Now,
can
Carl
I say
has,
my favorite
baby,
one?
Baby, It's Cold Outside down pat, so take that one, Carl.
Well, personally, I like the word context. You got to look at these songs and these things in context. When were they done? What was the culture like at that time? And so on and so forth. It's all within context. If you try to take today's mores and try to decide on something that was done years ago, today's mores, it's not fair. Because today's mores weren't around back then. You know, so I don't like this whole thing of what they're doing. I don't like it at all.
It's not a date rape song. We jokingly call it that because of certain words mean different things nowadays. Like, what was it? Christmas song? Oh, yeah. Don ye now your gay apparel?
Yeah.
Back then that meant happy. You're happy. Nowadays.
Yeah, but it's not just words. Really what they're referring to is more the morals and mores. Like Baby It's Cold Outside is a song really about seduction. A particularly seduction in terms of that time period, which was the 40s. You have to remember that if a woman wanted to have sex and was unmarried, that was a no-no. Okay, so it was like, you know, she wants to stay, but she really can't, but she wants to, and he's trying to make her stay.
And how quick did gossip go around town back in the old days? Hell, even nowadays.
What was that? Say that again, Steve.
How quick does gossip go around?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know.
But, yeah, it's harmless. It said at Christmas we like it. And, I mean, the millennials' biggest problem is they're too judgmental. They're too black and white for their own good.
You know, I mean, this is why I say the word context. They don't understand the history. They don't understand what the general feel was back then. And so they're taking their perception of what mores are and grasping them onto something that was 50, 60 years ago. And that you'll find all sorts of things wrong if you do that because it's changed tremendously.
Like, why did they call, going back to that, and this is going on, why did they call a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving racist?
Because there's a shot of Franklin at the table by himself, and everybody else is on the other side. And why is that? If you wait 2 minutes, it's because some people are late, and they come in and then sit down next to Franklin. Never mind.
Yeah, I mean, that's stupid. It's like they're looking for something to be racist. It's like they're sitting there going, oh, please, God, let this be racist. Oh, please, God, let this be racist. They want...
Well, the word
I have
right
never seen anybody fiend for being offended like we used to fiend to get laid.
Well, you know, the other thing about Charlie Brown, before we get into Red Nose Reindeer, you know, Charles Schulz was basically a black woman had asked him to include a black character. And in conversations with this woman, he then introduced Franklin, and he got a lot of shit for it. A lot of Southern papers weren't pleased. Some of them stopped showing it, and that sort of thing. This is the guy that broke racist barriers in the freaking comic strip world. And they're calling this racist? Know your fucking history, people.
But that called him to actually research something.
Yeah. That's what you're supposed to do. Never mind. And then this whole thing with...
No, it's true. You need to research. I mean, there's certain things like you don't need to research why a birth of a nation is racist.
Well, you do if you don't know.
No, all you need to do is watch like the first 20 minutes of the movie. You'll be like, oh, okay.
But this whole thing with Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and, oh, it promotes bullying, it promotes this. Well, okay, let me just go back a little bit. If you were different back in the 60s, and I speak from experience, you were bullied. That's the way it was. Okay? You think bullying is new? Oh, fuck no. Okay? Secondly, you look at Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, when it all comes down to it, it's the misfits who win. It's Rudolph. It's the kid who wants to be a dentist. It's all that because they persevere. They persevere. They go through it and they get stronger. That's the whole point.
Oh, when I was a kid, I thought a squirt gun that shot jelly be cool as a motherfucker.
Yeah.
Put some red jelly in there and shoot somebody? Goddamn, that'd be cool. You know what I mean?
You know, and a quick... You know,
yeah,
a Christmas
bang, bang, bang.
Too.
Ha, you got blood running down your chest.
But a Christmas story, too. You know, we were talking about that the other day. You know, this article...
That was
you know,
today.
That. Okay, it was today. But you know, what was the name of the book of short stories that came out of?
Yeah, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash.
Okay. So, you know, someone complained that it was consumerist. Look at the fucking title. The man was a satirist. Of course it's anti-consumerism.
The whole bit with the decoder pen.
Yeah.
That showed how consumerism destroyed your innocence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, ooh, this magic thing, I'm part of the secret club. It's a fucking Ovaltine commercial.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, people forget that Gene Shepard, you know, or don't realize that Gene Shepard was a satirist all his life. You know, the type of humor he used. he's rather gentle.
I love it because it's such a mean little satire.
Well, it's not nearly as mean as something like The Magic Christian. Not even in the same way.
Yeah, but it's still mean. You know what I mean?
Well, it's satire. But it's a more gentle satire. You know, it's more family friendly than something like Magic Christian or Network.
Well, don't forget, it flopped like a mother father when it hit.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone who's seen it on the big screen when it first came out. Everyone I know has seen it on cable.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, this cable or VHS.
Yeah, I've never been a big fan, to be honest. I've never been a big fan. I thought they made it too gentle with the satire and too family-friendly.
But still,
but, you know,
another thing they said, the movie is bad because the only positive things that the boy does is he gets a gun. And he beats up a bully.
Well, listen, if you beat up a bully, that's always a positive thing.
Yeah.
Okay? Always.
And he opens the article and he says, yes, I'm ashamed to be part of the most violent, ugly, and cruel species they are, who should be eradicated from this planet, the white male.
Yeah. No, again, I said context. You have to look at when something was done. You have to look at the time. Because whenever something's written or filmed, it does reflect the time that it was filmed in, okay, and the mores of that time and all that. And it is, to me, it's not only a shame, it's tragedy that we base our mores now and look at something in the past and call it racist without understanding that, you know, they're, you know, just like banning Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn. And we've done this before, you and I did a show on books.
Yeah.
You know, never mind. It makes my head hurt.
I mean, it's stupid. Let's see. Huckleberry Finn promotes racism. Harry Potter promotes witchcraft. Watership Down doesn't promote traditional family values.
They're freaking rabbits! They're not human!
Yeah. And it's an allegory.
Yeah,
if
really.
You want to read something, people, with toxic male syndrome, is like they call it toxic maleness, go get Lord of the Fucking Flies.
Yeah, but even that is anti that type of thing. It's not
right.
Pro that type. No. It's a cautionary tale.
Yeah, it shows what can happen. And basically, if you're against anything and try to make people not listen to it or not watching it, you're the problem, not the solution.
Well, you know, I don't believe in censorship as a general rule. I do believe, however, that if you have a group like ISF, that you have control over what you post for that, because otherwise you're trying to control people, you know.
No, there's a difference. Parameters are not censorship.
Exactly. Parameters aren't censorship. You know? So if you want to go, you know, spout your anti-gay and that sort of thing, I'm not going to stop you. But on ISF, I will. But that doesn't mean you can't be on ISF if you follow the rules and be a racist. And I got into so much trouble for that. You know, if people follow the rules,
people think their words are too valuable nowadays.
I think you have.
I'm worth worse shit.
Yeah.
Their words are so valuable and precious that if you tell them they can't say, you are banning the word of God itself that would save the world, that would cause bald men to get hair on their head. Their words are more important than Viagra.
Personally, I'm a Cialis guy, but that's beside the point.
That's just their value of self-worth, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I know exactly what you mean. It's a shame that we lose so much. I mean, again, we go back to what this show was about, and this was a tribute to Bleeker Bob. Those places were safe places, and certainly the store that I had was a safe place for these kids to come in and talk and have a real conversation. Have some socialization with friends of theirs, and feel like no one else is gonna bother them. I didn't tell Joey this, but you've heard this story from me. But I remember being in the store, and there was this kid that walked in, and this was in the early 90s, and full goth regalia. I mean, total black with the veil and everything. Right. And I was at the store and I had XTC on the boombox. And he comes in and he's like, oh, XTC. And of course, you know, I've been in the East Village. I've seen people with green mohawks. I dated a girl with a red mohawk. This didn't bother me. Didn't even faze me. And Sean, his name was Sean Burdick, and unfortunately I've lost contact with Sean. But, you know, you treat people with kindness and you'll get a response. And that to me is the crux of an independent store, of just being human. You know, and just trying to connect with people. What?
Yeah. What was it the Beatles said, Carl?
All you need is love?
No, the love that you make is always equal to the love that you take.
Yes.
You only get what you give.
Exactly. No, and so, you know, those things are important. So I really don't have too much more, Stephen. You got anything more you want to go over?
Let's see. I hold about 25 minutes, but really, honestly, people, if you're going to do something this weekend, tell your friends that you talk to all the time, you love them, give them that for Christmas. It ain't about money. It's showing them that you give a shit.
Yeah, I agree.
And my fellow nerds may be dumbasses, but I love them all.
He even has me on the show.
Yeah. And to all you people that are calling Charlie Brown Thanksgiving racist and that Rudolph is promoting hate, I wasn't going to do this, but you're forcing me to do this. We got a show we have to do now in January as a teaching tool.
Uh-oh.
We're going to do a live watch of Fight for Your Life.
Oh, fuck. Oh.
I'm sorry,
oh, good
but
God.
They've asked for it, haven't they?
Yeah, I think they have.
Yeah. This is going to be one we're going to put, I'm going to put big warning signs on.
Yep. Yeah, you need to do that.
And with that, good night, have a happy holiday, and listen to the worst Christmas songs ever on Friday night from Carl. And on Sunday, me and Mike are going to be doing the big gun down.
Oh, man, that's going to be fun. I'll miss that. Tell Mike I said hello. And listen, thank you very much for having me on, Stephen. And good night, people. It's been a pleasure being here on KSDAD.
And support your local record stores or local stores, period.
Absolutely.
And not just on local store day, every motherfucking day. Oh, and in Knoxville, if you're looking for a good movie to watch, go to Central Cinema. If you don't like the movie they're playing there, walk across the street to Ravens Records.
There you go. Absolutely. Support independent record stores. Good night.
Night.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Blood chamber pressure increases. It's at
full. All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Blue Magneto's right. There's a war coming.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
You sure you're on the right side?
Hasta la vista, baby.